SCP-1929, Discoherence. During the 1930s, across the Great Plains of the US and parts of Canada, a period of severe dust storms greatly damaged the agriculture of the region, being known as the Dust Bowl. It was caused by both multiple periods of severe drought, as well as farmers failing to properly employ dryland farming techniques, creating massive amounts of dust that whipped into huge dust storms known as black blizzards. It ended up affecting 100 million acres of land and forced tens of thousands of impoverished families to abandon their farms, many of them migrating to other states, only to find that the Great Depression was just as bad. It's not an especially glamorous period of US history, and so is not often discussed much anymore, but it does live on in various works, like Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. As rough as it was to live during the Dust Bowl, however, it was still better than what the SCP universe has to offer, which takes the dust storms and makes them truly horrific. Let's take a look. SCP-1929 was a meteorological phenomenon which occurred throughout the lower Great Plains of America between 1930 and 1938. The SCP-1929 events were similar in appearance to non-anomalous dust storms common to the region at the time, but would manifest exclusively in the vicinity of small townships and remain in place for days or weeks at a time, unaffected by wind conditions and other meteorological factors in the surrounding area. Physical substances and immaterial concepts within the active area of one of these occurrences became prone to spontaneous bouts of mutability between their original form and a loose collection of particulate matter resembling dust. The nature of this disintegration process varied, with some subjects experiencing partial disintegration, some experiencing it uniformly while others were irregular, and the process could occur gradually, incrementally, or in rare cases, instantaneously. Subjects might eventually reconstitute to their original form at various intervals, but repeated cycles of disintegration and reconstitution are believed to have proportionally reduced the likelihood of reconstituting correctly, leading to the mutation and/or amalgamation of destabilized subjects. In other words, objects, people, and even concepts within one of these dust storms were being turned into dust themselves, with some returning to their previous form, but some things were being disintegrated multiple times, reducing their chances. Leaving an active 1929 dust storm was possible, though rarely successful, and subjects affected by them were unlikely to maintain physical integrity when removed from its active area, often disintegrating entirely within 48 hours of leaving, with no chance of reconstitution. Both wholly and partially disintegrated subjects have been noted to retain function of certain biological, mechanical, and/or intangible apparatuses, regardless of whether the components necessary to achieve that function had disintegrated. This was most commonly seen in cases of human limbs and mechanical devices continuing to function in the absence of a visible source of blood or fuel. Furthermore, affected human subjects have reported experiencing stimuli from disconnected and/or disintegrated sensory organs. We're shown a picture of a woman undergoing partial disintegration, with her head collapsed into dust. Despite this, she reportedly retained the ability to converse, but was too disoriented to stand. Although the extent to which 1929 affects consciousness is still poorly understood, a 1943 study determined that samples of particulate remains from previously living subjects scored an average of 12 to 22 on the Rhine-Fort psionic resonance scale, notably overlapping the 20 to 23 scoring range associated with awareness and the capacity for intelligent thought. This test was repeated in 2011 using the same samples, and the results suggested that there has been negligible diminishment in conscious energy since the 1943 study. That's certainly a horrifying thought. The largest and most well-documented manifestation of 1929 occurred in Sousa, Oklahoma, on March 14, 1935. The entirety of the town's residents and properties lost physical coherence as a result of the dust storm, as did the Class D response team sent by the Foundation. The remnants of the event are currently stored in the eastern wing of Site 31. The storm initially manifested around the town at 3 a.m., with resident Ray Coate eventually leaving the active area in his truck around 7:30 a.m. His truck was seen traveling westbound towards Enid, Oklahoma at great speed, with him soon arriving at the Enid Springs Hospital, clearly in extreme distress, carrying a set of bed sheets knotted into a bundle. He claims that the bundle contains his wife, who has been reduced to dust, and he begs the hospital staff to reassemble her. Witnesses there believe him to be having a psychiatric crisis, and security is contacted. A few minutes later, a security officer arrives on the scene, but fails to calm Coate down, so he's instructed by medical staff to forcefully detain him for medical evaluation. The altercation causes Coate to drop the bundle, spilling his wife's remains across the floor. He falls to his knees and attempts to gather them back into a pile using his hands. The officer moves to grab Coate by the waist, but his hands simply pass through Coate's abdomen and clothing as they collapse into dry granules on contact. Coate weeps, but doesn't display any direct awareness of his condition. His partial disintegration provokes a panicked response from immediate bystanders, alerting him to his condition and drawing the attention of additional hospital staff. A state of pandemonium then ensues, with Coate's body being further damaged by human contact. At some point in the chaos, Coate mentions that his child is still in his truck outside. One bystander, a member of the hospital staff, attempts to provide Coate a swift death by stomping his head repeatedly, which seems like a bit of a bold choice. Upon seeing Coate's fingers continue to gesticulate, the staff member crushes every remaining piece of Coate's body until it is fully disintegrated. A Foundation informant embedded in the local telephone system then learns of the 1929 manifestation and promptly submits both an incident alert and dispatch request to Site 31 in Tulsa. Onlookers gathered outside the hospital report hearing a child's voice emanating from the tailpipe of Coate's truck, but find the vehicle otherwise unoccupied, and 40 minutes later, the truck itself disintegrates. The vehicle's engine continued to be audible until the following morning, while the child's voice has infrequently persisted to the present day. The Foundation's first contact with the residents of Sousa was a phone call between Site 31 communication specialist Bea Ross and Deputy Sheriff Arthur Hastings, facilitated by switchboard operator Uma Pristine. As Ross begins speaking, she's quickly cut off by both of the residents, exclaiming that they need help. Ross explains that help is on the way, but asks what exactly is happening there. Hastings says that a storm whipped up in the dead of night and hit just after sunrise. They could tell it was bad, just seeing it coming, but people have been saying all kinds of things on the telephone and screaming, asking him for help, and what could he do after what he'd seen? Ross asks him what he saw, to which he says that he swears he stepped out and there was a woman's face up on a fence, caught on a nail, flapping in the wind like a piece of cloth. It was screaming, and she was still screaming as she blew away. Pristine interjects to say that he's telling the truth. They've all been seeing these things, and she begs for help. Ross explains that she does believe them, and their people will help them out as they deal with these things. Hastings doesn't know what else he can provide, though, as he's just the deputy. The sheriff went out, all wrapped up with goggles on, and he seemed fine. When he took the goggles off, however, he kept rubbing his eyes, saying that they got dust in them. Hastings told him to stop, but he wouldn't, and he kept rubbing his eyes until it was like he ground them all up right out of his skull, and he didn't even notice. Then he went right back outside and said that they took his eyes. He said that he had to get them back because he didn't like what they were making him see. Ross asks who he was talking about, but Hastings ignores the question, just asking her when the help is getting here. Ross repeats the question, and Hastings hesitates before explaining that they cover up the windows around here to avoid the dust, but when the sun hits it just right, they see shapes outside, shadows against the sheets. Sometimes they're shaped like people, and sometimes they talk like people too. He says that they've been coming here every day, to which Ross asks if he means that they saw them before the storm, but before Hastings can answer, Pristine begins making a loud, unintelligible noise, which turns to screaming. The screaming continues as Ross gets no response from either of them, followed by the sound of strong winds and creaking wood. She eventually hears an unknown male voice apologize, saying that that wasn't the deputy. It just thought that it was. No further responses were received, and connection was lost after several minutes of wind and indistinguishable noise. A field team composed of 12 Class D personnel was deployed to the town to document the phenomenon in action, although official documents from the time state the purpose of the expedition to be civilian recovery, despite the team being provided vehicles with no room for additional passengers. Of the 3.5 team members who returned, only 2 still possessed sufficient physical and conceptual cohesion to communicate their experiences. These testimonies were compiled into a report, along with some memories inadvertently inhaled by the presiding doctor while examining the partially deconstructed team members. The team arrived at the outskirts of the town at 10:18 a.m., noting a stark delineation between the active area of the storm and the relative stillness of the environment around it. One D-class likens the appearance of the storm's edge to that of a solid wall. The team donned goggles and handkerchiefs on their faces and breached the border of the storm at 10:31, causing timekeeping devices to immediately stop functioning. The members are initially disoriented by the loud winds and dense clouds of dust, but gradually come to feel an innate awareness of each other and their surroundings in spite of the storm, with this awareness persisting for the entirety of the expedition. Although the expected time to reach the town itself from the outskirts should be around 9 minutes, the time spent is a matter of disagreement among the D-class, with time ranging from 2 to 12 hours, with no residents or fauna observed during this time. When the team approaches a homestead with an open front door, 3 members are sent inside to investigate, with one emerging sometime later, describing the interior as being just more outside. He is accompanied by another member, whose left arm has disintegrated below the elbow. The third member does not return, although the other D-class report feeling his presence. The deterioration of the D-class's arm continues over the following minutes, ending just below the shoulder. He is distressed, but claims that the injury is not painful, and his condition alarms the other members, with 2 of them discussing the possibility of deserting the mission before being chastised. An argument ensues between one of them and the team leader, quickly escalating into a physical altercation until the team leader pulls his firearm and shoots the other for insubordination. The bullet strikes his lower abdomen, although there is no blood or pain, and the D-class attempts to examine his wound. This causes the surrounding flesh to disintegrate on contact, and he laughs before bidding the team goodbye and disappearing into the storm on foot. Another D-Class attempts to return to his vehicle, but his hand becomes inexplicably stuck to the handle of the door, becoming rigid and brittle. Another member removes his hand with force, snapping off several of his fingers in the process and causing him to enter a state of shock, appearing disoriented. He expresses less displeasure at the loss of his fingers than the fact that the tattoos on his remaining knuckles no longer spell out a complete word, and he briefly attempts to resume his duties driving the vehicle before the leader orders another to replace him. As the convoy moves further into town, structures encountered are found to be in various stages of disintegration and are often spaced unusually distant from one another or very close, occasionally intersecting at odd angles. Team members frequently report shadows resembling groups of people in the distance, but attempts to investigate these sightings are consistently ineffective, with the shadows appearing to move further away from the convoy at the same speed that they are approached. After some time, the D-class that lost his arm remarks that it is almost noon, despite his watch having disintegrated as well. Whilst the others are initially dismissive of his statements, another D-class notices that his own watch, though still non-functional, is now fixed at 11:55, with the others' watches showing the same. The team agrees that more than 2 hours should have passed, but they are unable to place the direction of the sun in the sky. The one that lost some fingers offers to resume control of the vehicle, with him now having regained possession of all of his fingers and having no memory of losing them. The rest of the team refuses to drive in the same vehicle as the two D-class affected by the storm, so the two are allowed to have their own vehicle while the rest cram into the others. Two of the D-class, after sitting next to one another for some time, discover that they have fused at their shoulders, and after some difficulty are made to ride with the other two affected members. When they are moved into the other vehicle, though, another D-class is found sitting in the vehicle, claiming that he's been with them the entire time. He attempts to get one of them to corroborate this, but he's too distressed by his own deteriorating lower body to communicate rationally, and the other only smiles, ignoring any questions posed to him. The convoy hesitantly resumes, but they encounter no structures, living beings, or vegetation for an extended period of time. The team expresses unanimous confusion as to why the sun has not yet set, and the one disintegrating D-class continues to fall apart until the effect finally halts halfway up his lower jaw. He remains conscious, but his speech is impeded by the exposed underside of his mouth, and while the other occupants of the vehicle are disturbed by his condition, none of them are willing to touch him to remove him from the vehicle. One of the other D-class in the vehicle grows increasingly distressed and attempts to leave, but is held back by the other D-class fused to his shoulder, who loudly protests. The two pull themselves in opposite directions until they forcefully split, with one's head and shoulder still attached to the other's body. He attempts to remove the head and shoulder with repeated strikes, but only manages to instigate a disintegration of the skin, so he eventually grabs his own head, twists, and throws it into the storm. Both of their headless bodies continue to thrash in the dust. A third member of the vehicle covers his eyes, inadvertently causing his goggles to crumble to dust, followed by his eyelids. He opens his mouth to scream, but he makes no sound. The last member of the affected vehicle, who has continued to smile the entire time, signals for the convoy to move on, leaving the thrashing bodies behind. Travel then continues uninterrupted until one of the team members makes an unauthorized break from the convoy, claiming that he needs to urinate. As he exits the vehicle, other members witness a humanoid silhouette emerging from the storm, with it being unusually large and possessing a number of sharp protrusions jutting from its head. As the shape becomes more distinct, the winds grow quiet, yet increase in intensity. And yet, despite this, the D-Class doesn't appear to hear the others calling out to him. A noise like thunder then reverberates through the storm, and the convoy suddenly comes under heavy fire, though the assault only lasts less than 5 seconds. Inspection of the vehicles afterwards showed that several dozen pairs of ornate embroidery scissors had been driven into the sides of the vehicles at high speed. The member that left the vehicle was heavily damaged by the attack, exposing mixed quantities of dust and viscera, and the damaged pieces of his body remained in place for a few moments before falling and bursting on the ground. His arms, however, are left suspended in their original positions. His hands grasp about frenetically, then stop and reach for the door of the vehicle. The team leader holds the door shut from the inside and takes control of the vehicle, ordering the convoy to move. The wind and its sound return to their previous state, and the humanoid silhouette is no longer visible. The team lead directs the team to seek shelter, and after searching for a period described as lasting hours, they finally encounter a farmhouse that had been completely bisected, leaving the interior of the home exposed to the storm. One team member volunteers to investigate it, however, and he notices a woman moving around on the second floor. At one point, she steps off the edge where the floor visibly ends, but remains suspended in the air, apparently interacting with a section of the building not visible to the team. The D-Class calls out to the woman, but she doesn't respond, so he walks around the area until he discovers a nearby barn, which had either gone unnoticed or had not existed in the last few minutes. He asks the team leader to help him find a ladder so that he can rescue the woman, but while the leader initially refuses, exasperated by the absurdity of the situation, he eventually relents, as the barn appears relatively intact. It takes both of them to pull the front door of the barn open, and while the interior is initially too dark to see, it's quickly illuminated by a surge of light, momentarily blinding the two. The source is a motorized wheat thresher, heavily rusted, with the nude upper half of a man fused at his waist to the front of it, just above and behind the rotary blades. The man's eyes are closed and his muscles are slack, and against the leader's orders, the D-Class approaches the machine, observing large quantities of human teeth strewn over the length of the feeding belt. As he moves to examine the interior of the mechanism, the man jolts awake and grabs his arm, throwing him off balance. The rotary blade array activates, but does not start at full speed, allowing the D-Class time to move out of the way. The two rush back to the convoy, but the D-Class's left foot breaks apart into chunks of grit. He continues to flee, first by jumping on his remaining leg until it snaps off, then by crawling along the ground by his arms, but he is not quick enough to outpace the harvester. He calls out to the team lead, but is ignored, and what remains of his body is subsequently caught in the threshing mechanism and completely torn apart. When it is over, he is still screaming, but there is no blood. The team leader reconvenes with the rest and declares that the mission is over, ordering them to move out. No response is heard from the third vehicle until one of them, the one who lost his goggles and eyelids, stumbles out of the vehicle. He's ordered to stay back, but continues to approach until he is close enough for one of the D-Class to see fingers grasping out from inside of his mouth, with tattoos visible on the knuckles. The rest of the team quickly hop into the vehicles and speed off, leaving the third vehicle behind. After some time, the remaining four survivors make the decision to travel in a single vehicle to conserve fuel, opting to siphon fuel from the other. To their confusion, however, they find the gas tanks of both vehicles to be full of dust. Since the engines continue to operate regardless, they decide to continue with both vehicles, agreeing that their best course is to continue forward in hopes of emerging from the storm on the other side. Not long afterward, one of the drivers confesses that his right leg has disintegrated and he cannot reach the gas pedal, suggesting that they leave him behind. Two of them agree immediately, but the third offers to drive his vehicle for him. The remainder of their journey is largely uneventful, but seems to last the length of 3 full days, with the sun remaining fixed at an indeterminate point in the sky. Very little is seen of the landscape besides a flat, dusty expanse, and as they travel, one D-class hears intermittent scratching from beneath their vehicle, but doesn't mention it due to fear of reprisal. The team leader apparently undergoes a gradual form of conceptual stability collapse, leaving only a rudimentary facsimile of his mind and body, but it does not relinquish control of the vehicle. At 10:32 a.m., the vehicles carrying the remaining members of the team are seen emerging from the storm at their initial point of entry. Upon return to Site-31, one of the D-class was discovered beneath one of the vehicles, fused face-first to the underside of the chassis. The back half of his body had been completely shorn off during travel, and his hands had been destroyed in his attempts to extricate himself. It's believed that he had hidden beneath the vehicle in an attempt to remain with the convoy undetected, fearing further violence from the team leader after their altercation, and became trapped as his body lost cohesion. This theory was not verified by the D-class himself, as his face could not be removed from the machinery. We're next given some logs of a couple of radio broadcasts sent out by KLPN, a daytime AM radio station based in the town. It only operated for 3 years prior to the dust storm, and remained intermittently operational over the course of the storm, during which local host Zeus Erthos made several broadcasts. In the first one, at 8:56 a.m., Erthos asks his listeners if they believe in prophecy. He doesn't mean to cast doubt on whether they all believe the good book, but he's not talking about the Bible. He means the here and now, and asks if they believe that God speaks to the ordinary people of today, because he believes that he does. He then goes into a true story, saying that he has to get up for work real early most days, and his daughter Anne, who is around 9 years old, caught him heading out the door when she should have been asleep. She literally caught him by the leg, with tears in her eyes, begging him not to go. She claimed that Inky, her imaginary friend, told her that the world's gonna end. Inky is just a dark stain shaped like a smile on her bedroom wall that she talks to, so he told her that it was a bad dream and he sent her back to bed. He hasn't seen her since, although not for lack of trying, of course. When his truck fell apart and got stuck in a cow, he made the trip home on his own 2 feet, as he would walk through hell itself to see his little girl again, and he just about did. He made it home, but Anne wasn't there. She's gone, 'cause they got her, so she's one of the ones outside now. He says not to mind that, though, as he didn't come all the way back to the station just to state what he's lost. He's here because of what he found. He has spoken to Inky and says that he's got the answers. He remarks that that might sound strange, but it's hardly stranger than a burning bush, and if you've so much as peeked out your window the past few days, you probably don't find much of anything strange anymore. Naturally, the first thing he asked Inky was how to make it stop, and he was told the obvious answer: blood. The cost is blood. Always has been, and always will be. And if they work together, they can end this today. They just have to help him find someone out here, who still bleeds. In the second broadcast, at 12:55 p.m., Erthos tells his listeners to look out their windows, then cover their eyes, and then look again. It's changed, and they're someplace different now. He asks if they know how long their eyes were closed, or where they were, but says to not act like they know. He wishes he knew where they go when they close their eyes. For some, he doesn't think they ever closed them, instead letting it wash over them in an instant, and they never felt a thing. For some of them, though, they feel every moment, every part of it. They don't stop seeing when they close their eyes, and he thinks his might be closed right now. There's no telling anymore. An unknown female voice is heard asking where the kids went, but Erthos ignores her, continuing to say that your sight is there, but your eyes are dust. Your teeth are there, but your mouth is dust. Your mind is there, but your thoughts are dust. You wait for the end, but time is dust. The woman states that he's not her husband, and Erthos tells his listeners to not worry about her, as that's just Ma Duke, and she's in the floor, mostly. She thinks she owns the place, and he'd box her ears if he knew where to find them. None of that matters, though, and that's not why he's on the air, and in the air, letting them breathe up his every little word. He says that there's only one instruction he has left to give, and it doesn't come from a dark little smear on a dead girl's bedroom wall. His message to them today comes straight from him, or what's left of him, and he's telling them all to shut the hell up. To every jackass still clinging to his skin, get off, and to every whore clogging up his windpipe, get out. He knows they're all listening, and doesn't care if they're scattered across town in a million tiny pieces, as they still have radio. He tells them to get out of his body, get out of his mind, and get out of his soul. He specifically calls out George Caldwell, who he grew up with, and is now standing on his tongue somewhere, not to mention all those memories of his that he's got buried under his skin. That's too much for any man to take. And he tells George not to deny it, as he can see him with his good eye. He wants George out of him, every last bit of him, and that goes double for everyone else. A number of other voices are heard amidst the broadcast, with one of them stating that he'll watch your eyes, and he'll bite your teeth. Notably, this line links to another SCP article, SCP-1861, the crew of the HMS Wintersheimer. 1861 is another anomalous weather phenomenon that involves heavy precipitation and fog composed of salt water, human blood, and human cerebrospinal fluid. During the event, a World War I era submarine will emerge from a nearby body of water, and a number of humanoid entities will emerge wearing deep-sea diving outfits that try to convince others to enter the submarine. Those that do are transported to a world made up of liquid, and become the entities wearing the diving outfits. The captain of the sub calls it his Ark, and refers to the water place as the New World. When asked about people in the water place that are missing their eyes and teeth, he just says that the Watcher of Eyes and Biter of Teeth deemed them worthy. 1861 is also similar to, and potentially connected to, SCP-3300, the Rain, an annual anomalous weather event that occurs in a specific town in Montana, in which the entire population of the town dissolve into water and are replaced by a new set of citizens. In the third and final broadcast from Erthos at 9:27 p.m., he states that, in the beginning, the hand of God took the dust to form man, and it was good. He took the man's rib to make woman, and it was good. He took the woman's pain to make the serpent, and it was good. He took the serpent's advice to flood the earth, and it was good. On the seventh day, God tried to close his eyes to sleep, but they were already shut. An unknown voice then tells him to go again, and he states that in the beginning, all was mud, formed into hills and valleys by the beating of the buzzard's wings. Every living thing gathered together for a contest to stay awake for 7 days and 7 nights. The owl, the panther, and the bat succeeded, and it blinded them. Unable to hunt, the three soon perished, and the buzzard cleaned the flesh from their bones. The voice tells him to go again, and he states that in the beginning, all was earth, but there came a great flood. The creatures of the world lashed together rafts to escape, but selfish beasts gnawed at the bindings and tore the rafts asunder. Every living thing drowned except one family of men and one pair of every animal. When the floodwaters receded, the creatures of the earth looked to the sky for a promise, but all it held was a bird, the color of death. The voice tells him to go again, and he says that in the beginning, a man bedded his sister, and she gave birth to a son. The son bedded his mother, and she gave birth to every living thing. But the son could not sleep at night from the noise of every living thing, so he sent a flood that lasted 7 days and 7 nights. When the floodwaters receded, the son tried to close his eyes to sleep, but they were already shut. The voice tells him to go again, and he says that in the beginning there is the dust, and the dust brings life. In the end there is the flood, and the flood brings death. The voice keeps telling him to go again, but Urthos tells it to just put him back together, at least part of him, as he can feel them, and they itch. He then tells it to please just let him see her, but the voice continues to tell him to go again. Urthos asks it, how many centuries, calling the voice Inky, but it just keeps repeating the word again. There's the sound of gagging and of dust hitting the floor, and Urthos ends by saying that, in the beginning, a serpent told the dust that it was man, and the dust believed it. Lastly, we're given the sole remaining photograph taken by the Class D field team, an image of a lone figure standing amidst the dust storm. It's definitely an article that isn't going to offer much in the way of explanation, with it just being an unfortunate, inexplicable situation that caused absolute chaos for some unfortunate souls many years ago. There is a hint of a connection in there to SCP-1861 and 3300, but that only really lends more mystery to the entire thing, outside of the three all being meteorological phenomena. There's also a tale related to 1929, titled Dust in the Wind, and although it's certainly captivating, it definitely doesn't offer any further explanation, and only serves to reinforce how random and cruel these events were. The article does give a good look at a pre-ethics committee foundation, who simply throw a pack of D-class into an unknown anomaly to find out more about it. I suppose that they did find out a bit more about it, but this event occurred apparently 5 years after the first manifestation, and before they could eventually figure out what was going on with these dust storms or how to stop them, the anomaly disappeared entirely. It now has the PAUSA class, meaning that it's not currently active, but it could potentially reactivate at any point, sort of like the Dust Bowl itself. The Dust Bowl and the Great Depression were some fairly rough times in US history, but the SCP universe always manages to make things so much worse.